Thank you very much, Rachel. Can everybody hear me okay? Cool. And thank you very much to the organisers for inviting me along. As you'll have heard from that introduction, I'm not actually a trained microbiologist. That's why I'm talking on microbiomes. I lead a team, though, that is very strong in microbiology. And as a nematologist, I've spent a great deal of my career rubbing shoulders with microbiologists. I've actually co-led a microbiome project, so I have some knowledge of this. But perhaps the advantage of a nematologist giving this talk is that I'm going to give you some of the basic stuff to understand what microbiomes are. Then run through a couple of examples where I think there is opportunity to manipulate microbiomes for, I've added soil, soil and forage science, and then wrap up with where I think some of the future directions are. Clearly, I'm presenting this on behalf of a number of the members of my team, the soil biology team based between Lincoln and Ruakura. The two members in yellow are not members of my team, but they are a bioinformatician and a statistician. These people are absolutely critical to any work on microbiomes, just to deal with the sheer weight of data that comes out of these sorts of studies. So what are microbiomes? I put up two separate definitions here, which give you kind of a different flavour of how to think about microbiomes, and it also has an impact on the way that studies are conducted. So the first definition talks about a community of microorganisms, and they've listed bacteria, fungi, and viruses. They've missed out one of the big domains of life, and that is archaea. But that's okay, a lot of people do. We've been guilty of doing that in the past as well. It's those microorganisms that inhabit a particular environment, and especially the collection of microorganisms living in or on the human body. And a lot of definitions will include things about the human body. And that makes sense. That's where a lot of money's gone. That's where a lot of advance has gone. People will have heard about the sort of things that have been done in human microbiomes, looking at ways to fix things like C. diff, the gut pathogens. There's that kind of interesting but kind of horrible thing of fecal transplants. All of that sort of thing is involved in that. In terms of what we do in soil and plant space, we can build on what's been done in the human research, both in terms of methodology and directions. So that first definition is really the kind of one that people usually think about when they think about microbiomes. They're thinking about the actual microorganisms. The second definition thinks about microbiome in terms of the genetic material of the microbiota, again, mentions humans, and they refer to that as the metagenome of the microbiota. So this is not who the microbes are, but what are they doing? So those two sort of definitions, I'm going to give illustrations of both of those. But first, let's go back in time a little bit, quite a bit, back to when things first arose. So the reason I'm doing this is to give you a flavour in the next few slides as to why it is that microbiomes are so important. So we can see, and let's see if we can do a pointer thing. Yeah. So around about 4 billion years ago, the two great domains of life, bacteria and archaea, arose, probably in the sea, probably in some sort of hydrothermal vent. And they had the planet to themselves for around about 2 billion years. During that 2 billion years, these things took over the world. One of the really cool examples of some of these early microbes are these things. They look like rocky outcrops at low tide, but they are in fact microbial mats. They're called stromatolites. If any of our Australian visitors or anybody else has been to Shark Bay in Australia, they'll see these things. These things have been around for almost 4 billion years. And they changed the atmosphere of the Earth. When these things first arose, the climate of the atmosphere of Earth and the seas of Earth were quite different to the way they are now. So these things used to excrete oxygen. Oxygen was a waste product. These things bubbled away oxygen for so long that they changed the climate of the Earth. They actually rose the atmospheric oxygen, which had enormous impacts for everything that came after. So these organisms are called prokaryotes. That's because they don't have a central nucleus of genetic material. The genetic material is dispersed in the cell. So prokaryotes, bacteria, and archaea ruled the world for a couple of billion years before the next thing came along, and that's cells with a nucleus, eukaryotes, us. So because they'd had so much time to spread all throughout all of the habitats on Earth, everything that came after bacteria and archaea had to negotiate their way through life with bacteria and archaea. If you imagine setting up a business in a mafia-run town, you've got to work with the mafia, right? Or else you ain't going to be in business. And it's exactly the same here. The eukaryotes, as they arose, had to deal with microbes and archaea that were in every conceivable habitat that they wanted to live in. So they had to form associations with those microbes. And those associations have been carrying on for the last more or less 2 billion years until, we get. And I think that's a generous blue line for where we are, probably a pixel or two at the end. So you can see these things have been around an awful long time, and I've really got the hang of how to live on Earth. I put up this diagram not only because it's really, really interesting and explanatory, but also it's almost like a work of art. I really like the aesthetics of it. So this describes very elegantly what I've just been saying. So bacteria and archaea, the two great domains of life, arose probably in some sort of hydrothermal vent, and some of these have been extant for a good part of that time, like our stromatolites. But then an event occurred here where the two great domains joined together to form the eukaryotes. So effectively, all of the multicell organisms are really a fusion of bacteria and archaea. We are microbes, really. And mitochondria are a really good example of that. They are the remaining bacterial cells within our cells. And that occurrence happened again. So there was a second fusion between eukaryotes and bacteria, and that was chloroplasts, and that allowed the rise of plants which could photosynthesize. So being around for 4 billion years, covering the entire planet, gets you a really good chance to diversify. And this illustrates it really well. So this is the family tree of all of life on Earth. It was published a couple of years ago using a number of different sequences. And you won't be able to read the details, but you don't have to, because this is bacteria, and that's archaea. So that's all of the diversity of the prokaryotes. That little green bit at the bottom is the eukaryote. That's everything else. To give you a concept of that, the fungi and all of the animals are one of these little things. This little branch here is the plants and most of the algae. So life on Earth is really, really dependent upon prokaryotes. So going from the general down to the plant and soil side of things, if we run through a plant generation and look at all of the ways that microbes and therefore the microbiome interact with the plant, if we start at the seed, we've looked at white clover seed. This is not a white clover model, it's a general model, but we see an awful lot of diversity of microbes within the seed. And these things persist for an awful long time. So we've looked at clover seed that was harvested 40 years ago, and there's still microbes in that seed. As the seed germinates, those bacteria proliferate into the roots and the shoots of the plant. We've pulled out bacteria because in white clover, the majority of the microbes are bacteria. We've pulled them out, grown them up, and put them back onto other seedlings to see what effect they might have on plant growth, to kind of figure out what some of the functionality might be there. As we expect, most of them do nothing. Some of them make the plant grow worse, especially the odd fungi that we pull out seem to be pathogenic. But some of the bacteria make the plants grow better as well. So it's entirely possible that some of these bacteria that are in seed are there for the benefit of the plant as it grows. As the plant matures, it becomes exposed to all of the other microbes out there in the rest of the world. So the soil, the air, water, all of those microbes are now exposed to the plant, and they enter into the plant as well, plus interact at critical points like leaf surfaces, but especially in the root zone, the rhizosphere. Then as the plant matures, some of the microbes can actually travel up the reproductive parts of the plant back into the seed, and we know that's true for epichloe fungi, which I'll cover off in a little bit. But intriguingly, a publication that came out last year suggested that actually microbes that get into the flowers just before seed is formed may actually become part of the seed microbiota, raising the tantalising possibility that you could actually inoculate these things just before the seeds form. So that's a single plant generation. But if we look back in evolutionary history, these things are associated all the way back. So a nice study that came out a few years ago, they looked at what microbes were in seed of current generation maize, and they looked back into the Teosintes, the progenitors of maize, and they found a really high match of sequences that are present in the precursors to maize and are still present in maize that's being grown today. So obviously these things are important enough to persist all the way through evolutionary time. So those little examples we're thinking about the actual microbes. But if we take the nature definition and think about the genetic material, we can think of the microbiota as a second genome that's associated with a particular environment. And I've denoted that here as big G for genome and subscript M for microbiome. So when we think of plants, we think of them as an interaction between the microbiome and the plant genomes. So it's genome of the plant by genome of the microbe. So G by G interactions. So they are effectively a superorganism. It's not just, when we think about plants, we don't think about them as just a collection of plant tissue. It's the interaction of the plant tissue with the microbes. And that superorganism interacts with the environment. So plant breeders, you'll have heard them talk about G by E interactions. Now they've got G by G by E interactions. And we also need to think about the environment influencing both of those genomes separately, especially in soil. The genome of the microbiome in soil will interact with the environment, as will the plant. So all of this makes the whole thing much more complicated. And I'm sure plant breeders are thinking about how to deal with G by G by E interactions rather than just G by E, but also potentially much more powerful. So at the moment, if we think about how it might be that microbiomes could be useful and potentially valuable in agriculture, if we look at what we've got currently with single microbes, we've currently got two microbes in New Zealand and other countries as well that add hundreds of millions of dollars to the New Zealand economy every year in plants. That's rhizobia, a bacteria, and epichloe, a fungus. Rhizobia are the bacteria that form symbiotic associations with legumes to fix nitrogen for the plant. In New Zealand, white clover is the most widely grown legume, and that the value of the nitrogen that's fixed by rhizobia contributes about $1 billion a year to the economy. That's a combination of the actual nitrogen that's fixed, so imagining what it would cost to replace that with urea, for example, plus the extra plant growth you get from that rhizobial association. We have a current project looking at developing more efficient strains of rhizobia, keeping that number in mind. If we can get even a proportion of extra $1 billion, that's a big number. The other microbe is epichloe. This is a fungus. It lives entirely within the plant. The dark blue kind of curly stripes up there are the fungus growing intracellularly in the plant tissue. The fungus produces compounds that protect against invertebrate pests, and here I've got the African black beetle, which is present in the northern part of the North Island of New Zealand. It's also present in Australia. It's not quite that big. It's quite large, but not quite that big. But by protecting against that pest, we get much better pasture growth. So, for example, this plot here is planted with the endophyte infected grass AR37 versus the one next door that isn't. And similarly here, this has an endophyte, this one doesn't. And a recent analysis showed that each new Epichloe strain that's introduced into New Zealand contributes about $200 million annually to the New Zealand economy. So here we have just two single microbes in two separate plants that add hundreds of millions of dollars to the New Zealand economy, not only productively, but also by limiting what we need to do in terms of adding nutrients and the environmental impacts that they would have in the New Zealand economy. So imagine if we could take, instead of working with just two microbes, if we could work with a handful of microbes, or two handfuls of microbes, imagine what the benefits might be. And that's what drives us in this sort of work. So the first example of work I'm going to give is around disease suppression. And this is harnessing what we think of as the soil immune response, and it's just like an immune response in humans. So pasture soil disease work has been in abeyance for a decade or decade and a half in New Zealand, and we're currently trying to reinvigorate that. We're focusing on dairying soils. And what we did is we looked at soil disease impact across three different regions of New Zealand, the Waikato, Canterbury, and Southland. And what we found was that in the worst affected area, in the Waikato, that between clover and ryegrass, we had 30 to 35 to 20% decrease in yield. And when we put that through a Farmax economic model, that was worth around about $900 a hectare per year in farm profit. So again, that's another big target for us to aim for, to try and see if we can decrease that loss. And how can we do that using the microbiome of soil? So to explain the soil immune response, some Dutch researchers have published this paper, which gives a really nice illustration of how it works. So in the graph, we have disease severity increasing up the y-axis and time across the x. If you start with the soil with low microbial diversity, in other words, it's conducive to disease, when a pathogen enters the plant, disease severity increases up to a peak. Over time, with cultivation of the same plant in the same place, you get a decline in disease severity as the microbiome increases in diversity in response to that pathogen challenge. So that by the time you get the second pathogen entry, instead of getting another disease outbreak, you get pretty much carrying along the same. So we call these two different types of immunity the innate immunity, so that's what's in this case in the soil to begin with, and adaptive immunity, so that's what develops over time with pathogen invasion. And, So this adaptive immunity happens a lot in arable situations because they do plant the same crops in the same soil year after year. And actually they kind of do that on purpose in some cases in order to get that effect of the adaptive immunity. In pastures, we don't really have that same luxury because we have mixed swards, we have grasses, legumes, herbs in a lot of cases, and on top of all of that, it's being grazed, things are moving around the place. So what we really want to get to a situation is where the innate immunity is at this spot rather than here. So how do we get a general suppression by improving the diversity of the microbiome? So our ultimate goal is to develop a practical management strategy that we can use to engineer the soil microbiome towards that enhancing that disease suppression. So we have a current postdoc student who during her PhD study looked at altering soil organic matter content. Particularly carbon qualities was the thing that was found to be important. So not just the amount of carbon or the amount of organic matter, but it was particularly to do with the aromatic content of that soil carbon that enhance the diversity of plant beneficial, bacterial taxa, and promoted soil suppressiveness. So we're following this up by looking at other ways we might be able to manipulate the soil microbiome towards a state where it's disease suppressive, things like changing the botanical composition, crop rotation, can we use other break crops? Are there organic amendments that can be applied? What about altering stocking rate? Those sorts of things. What sort of impact do they have on the soil microbiome? We really have little understanding about the distribution and composition of this disease suppression at this stage. It's quite early days. The bacterial family that Bryony looked at particularly was the Pseudomonas bacteria. And it's possible if this family was in fact found to be the one that seems to be responsible for some of that disease suppression, maybe we could use that as an indicator species in soil so that, and I guess this is more generally what we're thinking about in the microbiome space as well, is that when a farmer sends a soil into a lab, he doesn't just get NPK, you know, you might get a Pseudomonas measure that tells you something about disease suppression. There's some other things I'm going to talk about in a little bit that you might get. So, you know, getting some of those indicators of soil function may be the sort of things that we can develop as we go along. But really that study is kind of thinking about the who. What microbe is there? And so that was the Pseudomonas, you know, who's doing, who's there rather than the what. So this next example is about the what. This is about function. What are the microbes actually doing? It's a very busy diagram. It's not my diagram, but the thing I want to point out is this is around soil nutrient cycling and loss, and in particular nitrogen cycling. We know that there's an enormous stock of nitrogen in soil. There is a risk of it leaching. There is also risks of greenhouse gas emissions. And in this diagram, this person wasn't particularly interested in microbes, and so that's why microbes are here. But I'm going to concentrate on what actually happens in this bit here and how that might be manipulated. So I realize we're kind of into the post-lunch funk, so hopefully this isn't going to freak out people too much. But you don't actually need to concentrate on the detail. The point is this is the nitrogen cycle, more or less. It doesn't have all the players in it. Not all the arrows are quite there, but what it illustrates is that this is a cycle. But also the important point for the microbiome point of view is that each of these reactions has a little notation with it. Each of those notations is an enzyme that makes that reaction happen, and each of those enzymes is held within a microbe, either a bacteria, an archaea, or a fungi. So all of those reactions are mediated by microbes, some of them rate limiting. So knowing that, we can then think about, well, is there something about those microbes that we could actually manipulate in order to affect parts of that nitrogen cycle that we're interested in? We've already run across this bit. So this is the nitrogen fixation step, atmospheric dinitrogen being fixed into the soil, into the plants, ammonia via rhizobia, which use this nitrogen fixation gene. And actually in the program we were looking at improving, finding better rhizobia, we're looking at ones that have different NIF genes, variants of it that make them better at fixing nitrogen. The other one I'd like to illustrate is this part of the cycle. This is called nitrification. So this is going from ammonia that ends up in the soil either via nitrogen fixation or by adding things like urea to soil, and its breakdown through into nitrates. And we know that nitrates are that potentially leachable part of the nitrogen cycle. So is there a way that we can manipulate this part of the cycle to try and reduce the amount of nitrate that ends up there? So if we can inhibit that part of the cycle, and I'll just step back slightly to show that enzyme that does that is labelled MO, We'll just call it ammo for short. If we can inhibit that, that's called nitrification inhibition. People probably know where I'm going next. So this is some work that was done a number of years ago by a colleague, and this is looking at what happens to the bacterial ammo genes, the number of those genes, when we add either nothing, urine, DCD, or DCD plus urine to the soil. And I've highlighted the urine and the DCD plus urine. So DCD is a nitrification inhibitor that was on the market for a while, that John talked about earlier on being withdrawn from the market when it was found that there was potential for it to get into the food supply. So I'm not here to market DCD. This is just an experiment that we did. But it clearly shows that when urine is added to soil, over time, the number of those genes that are taking the ammonia through to nitrates increases over time and keeps increasing for a couple of months. That's when we ended our experiment. Whereas when we add a nitrification inhibitor, the number of those copies of those genes declines over time. So what's happening is that processes have been stopped at ammonia, and the ammonia is able to be taken up by plants. So this is about function. We don't care which bacteria have those genes, it's just about those genes. Interesting, we didn't find any similar effect for, we looked at the archaea in this case, we managed to remember to look for archaea. There was no effect on the archaea genes because bacteria dominated in the soil. But that's not always the case. I've just returned from Ireland, where we visited some colleagues in AFBI near Belfast, and they have been putting animal slurry onto soil for, I can't remember, 40 years, I think it is. It's an enormous amount of time. But in that soil, the archaeal MO genes are very important ones, that they've been upregulated in that soil. So if we were going to do our NPK Pseudomonas test, we would add MO genes, and are they archaeal or bacterial, and what might we be able to do to that soil to manipulate it to stop that nitrification happening. Now, given that DCD or any of the other nitrification inhibitors aren't able to be used in New Zealand at the moment, it's possible that we could do something like a biological nitrification inhibition. There's a number of ways to do that. People have looked at plants. Some plants themselves produce compounds that either encourage bacteria to outcompete or compete with the nitrification genes, or that produce compounds themselves that stop that nitrification. We can get really fanciful about this sort of stuff. This is quite, kind of out there. Could you add in inoculants that would help reduce nitrification? You know, these guys have thought about genetic engineering them, but this is the sort of thing that we need to think about. Breeding plants or adding microbes to plants that help with that biological nitrification inhibition effect. The other thing that I'm not going to cover, but the other part of this nitrogen cycle that's obviously really important, is some of those greenhouse gases, and maybe we can look at how we could manipulate the soil microbiome to reduce some of those greenhouse gas losses as well. So for me, the future of the microbiome plant opportunities, some of them there are plant breeding. So breeding for the microbiome, for a particular part of the microbiome that we want. We already do that with Epichloe. We already do that with rhizobia. What if we could do that with even more microbes? Looking at carbon quality control for disease suppression, and also potentially in climate change mitigation and possibly adaptation. Now, I've just put this up at the end. I talked about the human microbiome stuff at the beginning and how we kind of can line up with that. But also the rumen work that's going to be covered in a later talk as well, because what we do is quite similar. So we do the sequencing bit, that's all the same. Unravel the complexity and structure of the microbiome, that's all the same. And what really we can get from the human stuff is thinking about some of the outcome benefits that have come out of the human stuff already. What might be be able to do with if we did a similar thing with a pasture microbiome thing. Enhancing profitability and sustainability, microbiome solutions, new or altered plant traits, and benefits we can't even predict, because when people started out with the human microbiome work, they certainly didn't know what they were going to come up with either. So I welcome your questions. Thank you very much for your attention.